Let's have a chat with fellow retirement planner Devin Carroll from Carroll Advisory Group in this, the 90th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, as always, for listening. Today, we have another fellow retirement planner chat. Today will be no other than my buddy, my friend, Devin Carroll from Texarkana, Texas, owner and founder of Carroll Advisory Group. So Devin's been in the business a while, 20 plus years, I believe he said, and has been through different firms, different structures, started off in pure sales and eventually morphed and developed and got to where he is now with his own firm that is a advisory, charges a flat fee now. He was percent of assets and recently changed to flat fee, which was very interesting, very, very good to see. So change is definitely happening within the industry. Devin's firm is case in point. So Devin and I met him a handful of years ago by finding he's got an amazing YouTube channel with 400 and something thousand subscribers, mostly about Social Security, but he's got other stuff on there as well. He's a great advisor, but Social Security is really where he stands out, and that's kind of his wheelhouse. And so I was looking for some kind of oddball Social Security issue or question I had, came across his YouTube channel and just found this absolute amazing jackpot of great information and videos. So started following that and then came across his Facebook group called Social Security Intelligence Members Group, I think it is. You can find a link to it in the notes here. And was just people asking questions about Social Security. And I was kind of fly on the wall, sitting back reading. And I started, as I learned more about Social Security, I realized I was able to help and provide answers to those many of those people. So I started actively participating in his group and answering questions. And he, I guess he saw some of my contributions and reached out. And he and I started chatting and became friends. And the rest is history. So I like him a lot. He's a great guy. He's got a lot to offer and share and a lot of experience to pull from. So I'm happy he was willing and able to join me in this episode today. So without further ado, I bring you Retirement Planning Chat with Devin Carroll. Hope you enjoy it. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening and watching. We have a special guest this week, my brother from my Texarkana mother, Devin Carroll.
Thank you, Andy. It's always so much fun to come on your show and to see your youthful face that's frozen in perpetuity, obviously, at 28. I don't know how you do it, but
I stay out of the sun. I live in a cave. I don't know. No, I don't know. Boyish good looks, I guess, runs in the genes, thankfully.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, I'm envious.
Those who don't know, Devin has, he's the owner of Carroll Advisory Group down in Texarkana, Texas, and he has a phenomenally good YouTube channel all about Social Security and other things, but what, 400 plus thousand subscribers at this point, Devin?
Yes. Yeah. So really fortunate for that. Blessed, for sure.
Insane. Great podcast. Right. I've been on that a handful of times. I joked with you. My goal was to be the, what did I say?
Saturday Night Live reference. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. The guy, I'm drawing a blank on his name. He was in Roseanne, John Goodman, to be the John Goodman.
Yes, like, that was, you know, that was
frequent
it.
Host or whatever. But, yeah. So, anyway, we'll, you know, recap all your stuff at the end here, but Devin and I met because I found his YouTube channel a handful of years ago when I was looking up something on Social Security and stumbled across. I was like, wow, this is really good. And just went down the rabbit hole of watching all your stuff. And then found out you also had the Facebook group, the Social Security Facebook group, and just started joining that, listening, answering some questions. And I think you sort of found me from being a contributor in that group. And we linked up and I was honored that you reached out. And sort of the rest is history. Now you and I connect all the time with questions and kicking things around, and I'm happy to have got to know you.
Yeah, well, it's always nice to have knowledgeable peers for sure that you can turn to, because, you know, as much as we try to increase our own knowledge base, occasionally we'll hit a bump, right? And we need another set of eyes on this. So having folks like you to turn to is certainly nice.
Likewise. So thank you. But hey, Devin, did you know I once dated a magazine collector?
No. You got to tell me more.
Man, she had issues. Yeah, right? All right. And just in case you were wondering, I went to the doctor and said, I've got an earache, an inflamed sinus, conjunctivitis, and headaches. But he was dismissive. He told me it's all in your head. Yeah, because it is. So
why not?
Yeah, right. So anyway, so Devin, let's get rolling. Can you give a little quick background intro about yourself and your business?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, financial advisor based down in Texas. This is my 21st year to do this. The first 8 were spent at a big firm, and then I left and went out to an independent channel. And since then, it's kind of evolved up until about, I think, 2017, where I started dropping all of those registrations that allowed me to do the commission type business. And I just didn't want to do that anymore. Plus, it was really difficult when trying to grow a media channel to have all of those encumbrances there. And so, you know, since then, I've just been doing this on a fee basis, serving my clientele in the way that I think that people should serve their clientele.
Yeah. And kudos to you. So when did you get into this? I know you said you've been doing this a while. You started in a different channel, you know, a different business model, if you will, but kind of what was your background that led up to you getting into the business in the first place?
That's an interesting story, because it was not financial. And I think this is telling, maybe not where the financial services industry is today, but maybe so, but certainly where it was 20 years ago. So I was working for a wholesale company as an accounts representative.
Okay.
And my job was to sell. And in that role, I figured that there were some markets that were not being tapped correctly, and I went after them. And as a result, you know, as a pretty young guy, I was able to, you know, collect considerable and demonstrable sales experience on my resume that, you know, looked pretty good for a resume. It looked like, yeah, you know, I could go out and sell anything to anyone. It was based on that experience that made it possible for me to get noticed and land that first position. Because back then they made it very clear, look, your job is not to be a financial planner. In fact, the managing partner of the firm said that in those words, your job is not to be a financial planner. It is to sell investments.
Right.
And because I could sell, I suppose that's why I was offered employment. And that's where it started back in 2002. And then I think it was January of 2003 when I passed my final registration exam. And I was cut loose to go out into the masses and give them financial advice.
Just like that, right?
Just like that.
Yeah, it's people who follow along this show and my background know my thoughts on this. So much of the industry was, and unfortunately still is, very much a sales industry, sales culture.
Yeah.
Now, I don't mean that to denigrate sales, and a lot of the products getting sold do have their purpose and do have value and are needed in, you know, certain circumstances.
Yeah.
But when all you do is sell and all you're tasked to do is sell, and you only get paid by selling, it just so taints the process of people getting objective, good advice when they think they are, when behind the scenes, they're just out to get something sold to them. So not to be too much on the soapbox there, but it's, you know, I'm glad to see the industry slowly changing. There's more folks like yourself, like me, like, you know, all the folks I have on this podcast that are in it for the right reasons to actually give advice and do planning, not just hit some target or, you know, sell something to someone.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Sure.
Yeah. And now your business. So you're in Texarkana, Texas. Do you work just with folks locally, or are you, you know, a virtual business as well where you can...
Well, you know, when I first got started, obviously, you know, our job was to knock on doors, make cold calls, and that was strongly recommended.
Yeah.
Which was miserable, by the way. Mm-hmm. While that was strongly recommended, the one thing that was required was producing results, right? Which meant that you had to open a certain number of accounts, you had to generate a certain amount of gross production, which back then was, you know, commission. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, you know, those were all people right here in my local market. And so a fair number of those people are still clients. But now, today, the vast majority of my client base are virtual. And, you know, as much as I love to sit down across the desk from someone, most of my clients, I've never had that opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting how the world has evolved and it is so practical and feasible to do a completely virtual relationship with someone. Now, both parties have to be okay with that. And some folks aren't okay with hiring an advisor they met through the internet, right? And don't sit across from them. But for many folks, it works out quite well.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say so.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's get into some of the more pointed questions about your views and insights on retirement planning. So what do you think is one area of retirement planning that many consumers overlook or don't give enough consideration to?
You know, Andy, you and I have had this conversation on fees many times. And I think a lot of people, you know, if we just hit that, that's a big obvious one, right? That's one that a lot of people talk about, especially with investment fees. They talk about that, but, you know, they kind of shy away from the subject of the actual advisory expense that they're paying. But I don't think enough people pay attention to that. You know, I do retirement plan consultations because we've got kind of a couple of different products that we offer. One is just a one-time planning engagement. Okay. And so typically on Wednesdays and Thursdays, I have those days set aside just to do a consultation with people to help figure out if it's a fit for them or not. One of the questions that I always ask is, do you know what your fees are? And it amazes me how many times they will answer, well, I think it's this, or they'll just say, you know, I'm not really sure. I think that's something that absolutely needs to be paid attention to. Just yesterday, I was talking with a prospective client in Oregon. And when you look at the fee she was paying versus the fee that is proposed, right? Which was a flat fee. I mean, it was just in raw fees. If you just sum up the total amount of fees that she's going to pay over a 25-year period, it was $954,000.
Wow.
And then if you factor in the time value of money to that, where she would have just left those additional fees invested, it was $1.9 million. So I think a lot of people ignore it. It's a seemingly small number. But I think it needs to have more attention paid to it. The other thing, though, is just conventional wisdom. I think a lot of people are overemphasizing some of the conventional wisdom pieces out there, you know, like the conventional wisdom around asset allocation, the conventional wisdom around withdrawal strategies, filing for Social Security, you know, a number of things that you can get in Kiplinger's or Investopedia and some of those other publications and read about all day long, but they don't really have this, you know, that broad brush that they're using really isn't applicable to everyone's individual situation. And I think some people apply it that way, unfortunately, and it'll often you know, cost them either more in taxes or cost them some portfolio longevity.
Right. There are a lot of articles and videos where, you know, three things you need to know or five things you need to do with conventional wisdom, which by itself, conventional wisdom, I guess, is better than zero wisdom, right? But you have to realize it is generic. It is a broad brush to paint everything and everybody with. So that's where it gets hard. People don't know what they don't know that, oh, this is just some generic advice that may actually not do me best, right? You know, I'm an exception because X, Y, Z. And, you know, it's hard for people to know when to take broad stroke advice as, okay, this could apply to me versus like, yeah, this probably is, you know, could do more harm than good potentially. So not an easy one to dissect. On the flip side of that, I mean, maybe this is your answer, but what do you think people spend too much time and focus on? Is it conventional wisdom or is there something else in particular you think people overemphasize when thinking about retirement and retirement planning?
You know, so many of the people that I talk to, one of the big focus areas that they always want to talk about is the area of Roth conversions. And I think sometimes that takes a lot of focus away because a lot of times by the time I've talked to someone, they've already had a string of conversions that they've done.
Yeah.
And when you run that analysis out, it really doesn't make sense. You know, if you look at the tax code, it's somewhat actuarially neutral in that you're just going to accelerate your taxes up front. And in some cases, a Roth conversion makes beautiful sense, but it doesn't make sense for everyone. And I think sometimes people get fixated on that and they start converting or they over convert.
Right.
You know, not long ago, I was talking to a lady just down the road in the Metroplex of Texas, the Dallas area. And, you know, her advisor had recommended that she convert her entire IRA, which she was taking distributions out of, by the way, to live on. She converted the entire thing in 1 year. It was around $900,000+. And then after that conversion, she found out about not only how much that was going to drive her Medicare premiums up, but also then the 5-year rule, right, on conversions. And she was shocked because that's what she was living on. So, you know, I think there's some mistakes that can be made, but I will say with respect to Roth conversions, even though people do get too fixated on that, I still think it's a box you need to check. You need to at least see the data on that and figure out, does it make sense for me? Because you don't want to be 75 and looking back wondering, should I have done a Roth conversion? You know?
Right.
So I would, you know, check that box and move on. But for most people, don't be overly surprised when a Roth conversion doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Lots of people, and partly it's the industry's fault for being so vocal about conversions, and now's the time to do it before federal tax rates go up in 2026. And but to your point, it doesn't make sense for everyone. Rarely is it a slam dunk, obvious, in your face, objective, mathematical certainty that yes, go ahead and do this, it makes sense. There's lots of factors and a lot of subjectivity to it. And some people probably overdo it with conversions. My view is if you do overdo it, I don't think you're going to regret it. Like, fast forward to the future, I don't think anyone's ever going to be like, I wish I didn't have as much Roth money as I do. You know, now I can't put a number on what that thought is worth, but you know, I don't sweat it if you do potentially overdo it. Anyway, but well, it's hard to define what's overdoing it.
I'm with you on that. I generally do think Roth conversions are a good idea, but if you're looking for it to make that mathematical sense that you were talking about, that's where it doesn't often line up. But I think there's some other reasons that people could consider Roth conversions. You know, there is the whole crystal ball of, I wonder what's going to happen to taxes in the future. And at least this way, I won't have to worry about it. Right.
Correct. Yeah.
So even if it does cost me more now, based on what we know about the tax structure and the expiration of the Trump tax cuts at the end of 2025, so on and so forth, you know, this way it's taken care of. None of that's really going to bother me. The other thing that a lot of people will use as one of those factors to do a conversion is, Devin, I've got one kid and I've got $3 million sitting here in my IRA, and that one kid's a doctor or they're a chemist or they're whatever. They're making a high income. So the end result is going to be that more of my inheritance has to end up going to Uncle Sam than I wanted it to. So, you know, if I can pay $300,000 in taxes to prevent my son from paying $800,000 in taxes, whatever those numbers are, right? Just pulling them out of the air. I think that would be worth it to do so. And we've had a fair number of people convert specifically for that reason.
Yeah.
So again, I think that, you know, when you're using some of the Roth conversion calculators that are online, the only thing that it's looking at is, you know, your tax liability over your lifetime. And that's about the only effect you can find out of that. But there's some other reasons it should be considered.
Yeah, definitely. I'm fully on board with that. In your experience, and you know, you've worked with lots of folks, single and married alike, what are some of the major differences you've come across in planning considerations for single versus folks in a partnership?
Yeah, you know, it's always interesting when we do a plan for a single person. You know, if I had to quantify a number that most of the retirement planning clients need in monthly net income, which is kind of what we build a plan off of, the cornerstone, right? Everything else kind of revolves around that. In most cases, you know, we'll find a couple that may want $9,000 or $10,000. It's rarely exactly half that for a single person because it takes a certain amount to live, right? Especially if someone's recently gone through a death or a divorce. I mean, having the house that they're comfortable living in, the lifestyle that they're comfortable living, it takes more money for a single person to generate a required income than it does for a couple. Just plain and simple. Not only that, but then, you know, you've got the tax code that's not as friendly to a single person as it is to a joint couple. And then I think with respect to Social Security, there's some key differences there as well with a single person and a joint couple, because with a single person, you don't have to think about, you know, spousal benefits. You don't have to think about eventual survivor benefits or any of that. So there are some differences that get into a plan when you're looking at that single versus couple that do add some complexities for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Good points. Now, whether someone's single or in a relationship, obviously, you know, it's like I said before, you kind of don't know what you don't know. So it helps to get a basic level of education in things. With that said, do you think some people, many people, all people could or should do their own retirement planning? You know, it's not let's say it's a loaded question. This isn't here to sell advisory services, you know, this episode, but there are people out there presumably who don't need an advisor. So kind of what's your thoughts on how many people could or should attempt to DIY it throughout their retirements?
You know, in those consultations that I was talking about earlier that I have on Wednesdays and Thursdays, I truly have those as a fit call, right? Okay. It's not an opportunity to sell my services. And I've had a fair number of those people who have said, you don't need a plan. Now, they still need to bounce things off of someone occasionally. For example, we've had a client come in not too long ago who was wanting a plan, a prospective client, who we did not end up doing a plan for. And it seems like their monthly net income goal was around $12,000 a month. But when you add up their Social Security benefits and their pensions, they were at $14,000. So, you know, I have to look, I can't add a lot of value here. You know, you already have a substantial amount of income coming in, more than what you actually need in your monthly net income goal. So there may be some things we can do to help you optimize, you know, your retirements to maybe decrease those future RMDs and things like that. But as far as structuring out your retirement income, just don't really think you need that help. It's done. It's fixed. Right. So I do think that there's a certain crowd out there who probably doesn't even need a plan. Those are fairly few and far between, though. We've seen the incidence of pensions go down. And then others, you know, have hired us to do a plan just to vet the plan that they've already done for themselves. And they'll send us some really complex spreadsheets too, some things that they've been working on for the past few years. And, you know, going in and dissecting that sometimes is really difficult. But there's one commonality that I find with a lot of the DIY retirement plans, and that is that they run into a snag when it comes time to start counting the tax cost of different strategies.
Yes.
It gets really hard for them to measure the impact of scenario A versus B versus C. And so that's, in many cases, those people that have built those complex plans in Excel or whatever are coming back to us saying, all right, look, I need you to look this over and tell me what I'm missing here on the tax component of this.
Yeah.
So I guess the short answer is, yes, it can be done. But to optimize that, you may still want to go to an advisor who does have a deep understanding of retirement planning.
Definitely. And it's nice, like I, you know, you said that you'll meet with folks, you do the fit call. And in this example, people had 14,000 of guaranteed income and their expenses they wanted were 12. So it's like, yeah, there's some things you can do on the periphery for them to help them out. But you told them you probably don't really need this. And going back to being your small independent practice, as am I, it's so refreshing to be able to say that when you don't need to close every sale. One of the first people I met with when I started my business was a single guy. This was pre-pandemic, so I met in person in, I think it was December 2019 or maybe January 2020. He was like 65, still working, never married, no kids, lived modestly, had, I want to say $3 million maybe. He's going to get a pension because he's a public employee and he's working because he enjoys it. He's got some hobbies he does. So anyway, so we met. And he's got no particular legacy goals. When he dies, his money's going to go to like nieces, nephews. He doesn't have strong feelings about them getting the max possible, whatever. And so we're talking about Roth conversions and stuff. And I'm like, I don't know. Your biggest issue is having to pay tax on money you don't need. Like, I don't know. There's a lot I can do for you. I'm happy to try to help you on the margins. But frankly, like, you're good. It's going to be really hard for you to mess your plan up on your own. And so, you know, we left. He was shocked and grateful that was my answer. Like, I don't think you need to hire me. When any other sort of traditional large, had he walked to the major household name advisor on the street everyone's heard of, they would have salivated over him.
Oh, yeah.
He would have been $20,000, $30,000 a year of revenue. Super simple client that you can't mess up. And, you know, it made me feel good that I was able to give him the honest answer. Like, you don't need me. It's not worth paying me. And he was shocked versus the rest of the world would have just, you know, sucked him up and charged him a lot. But anyway, I'm getting off on a tangent here.
Well, that is a little bit of a tangent. And I'd like to add to that tangent if I could. You know, when I do these calls, so many of these people, when they answer the phone, you can tell they have their guard up. They have their wall up. Because sometimes I'm the second or third financial planner they've talked to, sometimes even more than that. And they are getting ready for the part of the call where I make my pitch. And it never comes, right? The pitch never comes. And so, you know, as we start getting into the call and we're talking more about, you know, their situation and their goals and, you know, all of that, and there's no product being mentioned. There's no service here being mentioned. There's none of that. You can feel that guard start to come down. Because I do think our industry is, let me hear your problems so I can figure out how to position my product for that.
Exactly. I got the solution. Let me now justify the problem.
That's right. Yes. Yeah,
it's backwards. It should be start with the problem, figure out if the solution makes sense. A lot of the industry is you have the solution you're trying to push on people. Now manufacture the problem to justify it.
Yes.
Oh, so dirty. Anyway. All right. Next question. So in case people are wondering, for those that don't know, this list of questions may be a little jumpy. It was crowdsourced from people in the Facebook group. And so it was like questions that you all wanted to hear me ask other advisors. So that's why it kind of sounds like I'm bouncing from one thing to another. But with that said, moving on. If and when people do start to search for an advisor or a planner, what things should they look for? What questions should they ask, in your opinion?
You know, there's a lot of articles written on this. And they mostly all say the same thing. And those are important issues for sure. You know, the things like, are you a fiduciary, right? And I'm not sure that the public still really understands the differentiation there.
Right.
So there's a lot of important things that you need to know up front, right? You know, do you charge commissions? You know, I would say, how long have you been in the business? You know, you don't want someone who last year was a band teacher necessarily. And I'm not saying that'd be a bad advisor, but you know, there'd have to be an expectation that they might practice on you a little bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of those early questions, yes, but I think the list of questions needs to go deep and it needs to be fairly invasive too. You know, for example, Andy, if you and I were sitting around drinking a cup of coffee, there are certain topics that we wouldn't go into that were personal in nature, right? Mm. So I wouldn't just look over at you and say, so Andy, tell me about what happens to your business if you die. You know, you might go, well, Devin, that's kind of rude. You know, I don't really want to talk about that with you, but I think when you're looking for an advisor, it's a monumental decision because that individual could have the potential to make or break your retirement. And there's a lot of things that you need to know. So, you know, for example, the question I just asked you, what happens if you die? I mean, that needs to be one of the questions that you ask because you need to find out, you know, am I just going to be assigned to a house account or are they going to put, you know, who's going to come in and take over this? Another big one. That especially if they are at one of the major firms. You know, we've seen this exodus out of the major firms where people are going into the independent channels, going to the RIA channels like we're in. You want to find out from that person if for whatever reason you have your trust and faith that this is going to be okay because it's a major brand name firm and you want to stay at that major brand name firm, you need to ask them, are you planning to leave? Mm-hmm. Because so many times these clients will join and then the next month, the next year, they get a notice that, hey, your advisor is no longer with this firm. We've assigned you to this person.
Right.
And it's just a mess, right? And then you have to potentially either learn that new advisor or transfer your account to another spot. But I don't think this is any area to be timid, to hold back, to worry about hurting someone's feelings. If they get mad and give any pushback when you're asking these questions, you need to take that in itself as a sign that the fit may not be right. I sat down with my team not long ago and I said, you know, we're getting ready to redo our website. And I said, we need to come up with all the questions we can think of that we've ever been asked. And I want to put those right on my website because, you know, there's two reasons for that. number one is I want to answer those questions in full transparency. But the second thing is that if someone reads something on my website that's disqualifying, right? If they go, oh yeah, Devin's not going to try to beat the market, or his investment portfolio is just, you know, a generic portfolio, I don't like that. Well, I don't necessarily want to take my time to have that fit call with them if we know that there's something that's not going to fit together. But the second thing is just to give people that information that they might be timid about asking. So I think it's absolutely important that you go down through someone's FAQs that they already have on their website and then start to backfill that with some other questions that, again, may feel invasive, but there's some things that you need to know before you hitch your wagon to that train.
I'd agree. Don't hold back. Don't be rude and mean about the questions you're asking or the way in which you're asking them, but nothing's off limits. I mean, this is an extremely important relationship and impactful. Could be good impactful, could be bad impactful. But whatever questions you feel you want answers to, ask. If he or she refuses to answer, I mean, that could be a warning. So depending on what it is, I mean, if you ask something completely random and personal, like, you know, whatever, I don't know, how much do you weigh? I don't know, something like that. Like, that's what's that going to add to it? But anything business related, about process related, even how they're compensated, do not be hesitant to ask, how are you paid? Do you get paid on making recommendations of, you know, buying X versus Y? Or that's all fair game. And if someone, you know, pulls back or refuses to answer, just get up and leave at that point. So there's no reason for someone to not answer those questions.
I agree.
Alrighty. Here's an interesting one. I think about more than I should. Can the quote unquote value provided by a good planner or advisor actually be measured?
You know, I would say no, certainly in most years. Occasionally, I think there are things that you can do that you can point to and say, well, look, I saved you $10,000 in taxes this year because we did X, Y, and Z. But I do think that most of the time, it's a small accumulation of things that makes it difficult to quantify. And, you know, I honestly wish it was not the case. I wish that we could quantify it, because then, you know, we could base our fees on that. But I know that there are some who say that they can quantify it, but, you know, we just have to admit the truth is this is not an industry where you always get what you pay for. It's just not. There's some people who, quote unquote, charge these premium fees, much like in the fashion industry, there are luxury brands that are basically the same thing as some of these other brands. They just have the prestige attached to purchasing that. And there's a psychological impact of that luxury brand impact, you know? So I don't think that you do get what you pay for. I don't think that value can necessarily be quantified, certainly in a year-over-year basis at all.
Yep.
I suppose, though, it depends on how you're quantifying value. If it's based on, let's say, returns, much like a hedge fund would charge, well, maybe then that's a quantifiable number. This year I got X percent return. But if it's the, you know, a planning relationship, it's going to be difficult to do.
Yeah. 100%. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't, for people that want an advisor or feel they need an advisor, that doesn't mean you shouldn't potentially hire someone because the value can't actually, you know, have a number put on it. It just means don't be fooled if someone tells you, like, I guarantee the value I deliver will be at least twice the fee or something like that.
Right.
Different years will be different amounts of value. Different people get different value, like the peace of mind value, for example. Some people are just super nervous and really, really appreciate knowing someone who knows what they're doing is there to help them make decisions.
Right.
And help them sleep. That peace of mind can be invaluable to that person. To someone else, they may not care about peace of mind. They may just be super analytical and be like, I want to see that your performance in this portfolio did better than the S&P 500. And that's all they care about, right? Like, that relationship's doomed to fail from the start. But different people ascribe different values to different things, which makes this question hard. So anyway, thanks for sharing. I like I said, I think about this more than I should. I'm truly fascinated to get different advisors' views on what exactly is the value of this. And anyone that says they got it all figured out, I know they're blowing smoke up my, you know what. But anyway, there's my bias coming out. So you got some great content sources, really educational sources. Where do you go from, not other than your own stuff, obviously, but what sources do you go to learn, to find things that you didn't already know or get additional info?
Yeah. So there's a few podcasts I like. There's a few websites I like. There's this podcast called, what is it? Retirement?
You know what I'm going to say. I'd never heard of it. I don't know. No.
No. And so here's the thing. And I tell people this. Andy, what you've done with your podcast is this beautiful combination of educating the public, but it's also in a way that informs our community as well. And usually it's either or, right? It's either industry specific, and the normal consumer would be bored to tears listening to it, or it's based on the consumer and it's stuff that we already know. Yours is somehow this fantastic blend of both. So, you know, beyond listening to your podcast, and there's a few others that I listen to. I do spend a lot of time reading in the POMS manual. Now, I know that sounds boring. That's the Social Security Program Operation Manual System, where they publish a lot of their rules, and it's their handbook for how to process claims and things like that. But that's where I can really dive into Social Security and learn a lot of that nuanced information that then when I share it, I know that what I'm sharing is accurate because I can back it up with POMS references. So I do find myself reading a lot of those types of sources, you know, and not as much in a market watch or things like that.
Yep. Agreed. Same with me. I listen to your podcast, you know, Big Picture Retirement, your YouTube channel. I've learned a lot from and still do for Social Security. But I also reference the Social Security POMS for really technical, hairy stuff. And same thing with IRS and tax code. IRS has a tremendous amount of information out there in the way of publications and instructions to forms and the tax code itself, which is not an easy read. But if you know where to go and how to interpret the legalese of it, I've learned a lot from digging at the source. So, you know, people ask, like, how do you learn taxes and tax planning? Like, sometimes there's no easy answer. You got to dig right to the horse's mouth and figure it out yourself in some cases.
All right. I agree.
So moving on to the practice specific questions section of this, interview/discussion/chat, you sort of started to touch on this, but how do you know if someone is a good fit for you, meaning a good client you'd be interested in thinking would make sense for your firm, as opposed to just you being a good fit for them?
You know, so there's two engagement models that we have. There's the one-time planning and then our comprehensive engagement, which is, you know, where we still do all the same planning, but then walk that journey with them and have our client service calendar. Those are the people that I'm most worried about having the right fit for, right? Because they're going to be long-term. One of my most important criteria is, you know, that not only do they align with our philosophy, right? Where they're not going to be a stock picker or, you know, trying to nail me to the wall because I didn't pick NVIDIA in their account or whatever, right? Yeah. But also, one of the big things is just that they're not jerks. I, you know, in my early days, you know, and when that producing was required, you couldn't worry about that kind of stuff. And so you got some real jerks that you had to do business with sometimes. And I just refuse to do that now. If someone's not a nice person that I would likely enjoy going out to dinner with or, you know, spending some time with, it's just really hard to have them as a client. So I would say that, you know, if you're a jerk, it's probably not a good fit.
Right. That's really important. And again, coming back to small practice, you can decide who you want to work with. You're at one of the large meat grinder places. It's anyone who can fog a mirror is a potential client that you got to go after. So I'm with you on that. Bit of an awkward question, but have you ever had to, I'll call it fire a client, you know, ask a client to leave, and why? Can you give circumstances around it if you're willing and able to share?
You know, so it's never had to come down to an official firing, right? Where I sent them some letter and said, hey, from this day forward, you're no longer a client of our firm. we had a couple get really close. And then I'm thinking of one right now in particular who came to my house mad about something. Mm. And, you know, from that point I said, yeah, you can't be a client any longer. And I don't know what happened. I don't know. He was having a bad day, maybe some emotional disturbances. I'm not sure, but he straightened up. And to this day, he's still a client and has been as nice as he could be ever since. But there have been along the way, a few clients who we were able to figure out, yeah, it's just not a good fit anymore. And we were able to come to a mutual understanding with them that they would be better off, in most cases, doing it on their own. Because of the reasons of them not being a good fit. Usually it was because, you know, they were trying to hold our feet to the fire because of performance or not knowing what the market was going to do or something like that. It's just not a good fit when you have that. And we were able to say, look, with, you know, in a nice way, we were able to say, hey, with all of this knowledge that you have about what the market's going to do, do it yourself.
Yeah, it makes sense. Side note, when you were talking about the client shut up at your house, did you ever see the movie Cape Fear?
No, uh-uh.
Oh, man. The original one came out, I don't know, 50s, 60s. And then there's a Robert De Niro version that came out in the early 90s about Nick Nolte was a judge that put De Niro into prison for something. I don't remember what it was. And then De Niro eventually got out. And then or he wasn't the judge. He was a lawyer, I think. And then De Niro got out and came after him and his family and was like stalking them, but not yet crossing the line. So, for example, Nick Nolte and his family were at the movies and De Niro showed up and like heckled them in a public theater. He wasn't directly, you know, harming them or threatening them, but he was heckling them. And then he just started like hanging around their family and it got worse and worse. Eventually he tried to kill the daughter and stuff. But it made me think of your client showing up at your house and like, you know, unexpectedly and unwelcomed.
Yeah.
It's a good, I recommend it. Cape Fear. Check it out.
I will. You know, and if you listen to the podcast for long, John knows by now, because he'll make these movie references, right? So my co-host, John, he just knows. Devin, have you seen? Never mind. That, you haven't seen it.
Just forget it. Okay. Yeah. Do you watch The Simpsons by any chance? There's also a Cape Fear spinoff episode of The Simpsons.
Oh, is there? No.
A while ago with Sideshow Bob was the murderer. But anyway. Investment management. So I think you already kind of... We got ahead of ourselves. What's your view on investment management? How do you approach it in your firm?
Yeah, just simple. You know, keep it simple. That's the way I do my own money. That's the way I do my clients' money as well. There's no need to overcomplicate it. You know, I think if we're adding complexity, we're just doing that to try to increase my job security.
Right.
You know, years ago, it still wasn't clear about the value of, you know, indexing ETFs, low cost, all of that. But as time has passed, the data that's come out has made it more and more and more clear to where now I don't think there's any question that keeping it simple is simply the best way to go for that.
Yeah. And this probably answers the next question, but do you do any sort of formal benchmarking of the performance of the accounts you manage versus some index or some pre-agreed target or hurdle?
You know, we don't. It's... When people ask us that question about what kind of performance have you had, you know, you can always look at our model portfolio and and see how it performed in the year prior. But I mean, the truth is that can be tweaked, right?
Yep.
You know, so if your dividend fund exposure didn't have a good year, well, you can just kind of turn the knob down on that a little bit and tweak that. So, you know, what I tell people is that, look, whatever the eventual asset allocation that you end up with comes up to be, you just look at those two markets blended together and that percentage, and that's about where you're going to be.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. Annuities. What's your view and usage and approach towards annuities in your practice?
Well, you know, what makes me sad is the term annuities. It really does, because it's such a wide net.
Yeah.
That's been cast over a group of products that has now gotten a really bad name. And I don't know what your experience is like, but I can't mention annuity to a client unless they've been a client for a really long time. Because the moment they hear that, they are pre-programmed to think, ah, that's scary. Mm-hmm. He's trying to sell me something. So here's here's kind of my opinion. You know, if you look at the big three type of annuities, and I know there's some others out there, but you've got fixed indexed annuities, you've got variable annuities, and you've got the, what they call the MIGAs, the multi-year guarantee annuities. Those are the true fixed annuities. You know, most of those pay a fixed rate for a fixed period, and then there you need to do something with it after that. So much like a CD or a bond, something like that. Mm-hmm. So those I have no problem with. I think as a position in the fixed income portfolio, we can often find those that are paying a better rate than what we can get in other fixed income. And then, you know, to boot, if it's in a taxable account and you've got a few years where you're still working and you need to kick some of that income down the road, they're tax deferred. And so there's a few benefits of that. But again, I've got to be really careful when I talk about those, because when you mention annuity, what most people think of are those other two, the yeah. ones that get all the publicity in the news, right? The fixed indexed annuities and the variable annuities. And what I'll often say about those two types of annuities is I think there's, and this is me casting a broad net here, but I think there's generally two types of people who those annuities are good for, the fixed index and the variable. And that's the types of people who are selling annuities and the types of people who own the insurance companies. And beyond that, I do think there's some application, right? Especially if you view it correctly. But the vast majority of those that are sold are not sold correctly. You know, they're sold as a way to get exposure to the market without the risk. Yeah. And that's just not the way they work. That's not the experience people have. And whenever I have people that are coming in and they have annuities, I have yet to find a single person that I can remember that's held one of those types of annuities for any extended period of time and is still happy with it. Not a single person. Because they'll all say, well, when I bought this, I thought, and they'll lay out what they thought would happen versus what's actually happened with it. Right. So, you know, I just really can't get behind those. Again, in the right situation, I absolutely do think it can be a good position. You know, for example, a fixed indexed annuity. I think as a piece of the fixed income portfolio, if you're viewing it that way, it could be an excellent piece, especially in years of lower rates. But I don't know, you know, selling it as a part of the equity portfolio and saying you're going to get the stock market returns with no downside. Meanwhile, I collect whatever the commission rate is on those, 7-8%, I'm assuming. Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah. They can get really complicated really fast, and education is key. But realistically, practically speaking, vast majority of consumers are never going to be able to fully understand one of these more complicated annuities like a fixed index annuity, where you have all the choices to make about the different ways in which you can earn interest, how that interest is calculated, and then add on all the potential riders or, you know, extra bells and whistles around death benefits and guaranteed return, you know, guaranteed interest benefits or step up enhanced benefits for long-term care needs or market value adjustments and surrender values. If you tap out early, it's like, how is a normal person supposed to understand this? So
right.
I think a lot of the post-purchase dissonance and unhappiness with the product down the road is simply, they just find out sometimes the hard way, like, this isn't what I thought it was, because they didn't get it. And it's partly their fault, buyer beware, you need to be educated. But realistically, they're just so complicated that many people just don't have it in them to fully get these things. But
well, I mean, here's the thing with, again, I'm going down a tangent here with annuities. It's not just the consumer, though, who is at fault here. What I have found is the vast majority of people who are selling these products don't understand them either. And then,
yeah.
Beyond that, we've had multiple annuities where we've looked through the paperwork and we just can't figure out these two or three different components. You know, for example, we can't figure out how does the income base actually pay out income and what happens if it gets to zero, so on and so forth. And so after reading through all the information, it's not making sense. And so we kind of throw up our hands and say, okay, it's maybe time to do the Hail Mary pass here. Let's call the company and let's talk to someone there. So we do that and we get them on the phone. And guess what? In many cases, they don't understand it either. You know, they're reading through the material and they're saying, well, I think what this is saying is Like, that's not good enough.
Like, yeah, stop right there. I didn't ask you what you think. Like, tell me what this, you know, what it does.
But, right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of folks in on the sales end of it in insurance products, annuities that, yeah, don't thoroughly understand it. And then that just shouldn't happen, but it does. Yeah. Thankfully, there are really good folks out there. And I'm not making this bit right now to sound like we're bashing annuities and all those who sell them. Annuities definitely have their place. There are a few folks, agents that I like and trust and work with and refer clients to, because I know they know their stuff. I know they're honest. I know they can explain well. When it doesn't make sense for annuity, these are the first folks I reach out to, as opposed to just letting people get thrown to the wolves and, you know, fend for themselves or trying to learn it. All right. Moving on to trusts. Now, I'm sure your partner, John, may have some thoughts here, but hot topic. Some people think they need a trust. Some people think they don't need a trust. A lot of the answer is it depends, but what's your view within your firm? And maybe if it's just limited to Texas, I guess, because trust necessity kind of varies by state to some extent. But.
It does. And, you know, I have to admit the estate planning side, I have a crutch there, and that crutch has given me some disability. So, you know, for the people out there who don't know, the co-host of my podcast is an elder law attorney who does this kind of stuff all day long. And whenever I have a question, you know, I just shoot him a text and ask him, and he responds back. As a result, I may not have learned it as deeply as I need to. But I still think, you know, my knowledge base in estate planning runs fairly deep, but having him as that backup sometimes probably has prevented me from getting in and learning it. You know, I got the wild hair not long ago, Andy, that, you know, I've practiced for 20 years, almost 21 years, and I don't have anything else better to do. I'm going to get my CFP because I haven't done that yet. Right. When I got started in the industry, it was kind of frowned on in that company I was in, you know, because it's like, you need to focus on sales, not getting some initials. And then I came into the independent space, and, you know, everything was really busy. Well, everything's still busy, but now I kind of get it. Right. I understand why we need to have that. So I went out shopping among all of the different education programs that are out there, because one of the pieces that you have to do is, you know, you have to have a bachelor's degree, and then you have to have this education piece that you fulfill. So I did my education piece for the CFP, completed that. It took me 2 or 3 months to do it. But the estate planning piece that was in there, I thought, man, okay. Yeah. I can tell now that I've been leaning pretty heavily on John for this stuff, you know, and just telling clients that, all right, listen, this is what we think. Call John. And as a result, again, maybe a deficit in knowledge there.
Right. Which is completely fair. And I think it's incumbent upon advisors to know your limitations, be good at what you're good at, but you can't be all things to all people. You can't be an expert in everything, especially in a case like yours, where you have someone who is truly an expert that you work side by side on. Why wouldn't you lean on him,
right,
to do most, if not all, the heavy lifting when it comes to estate planning, you know? So
yeah,
I think you're going about it the right way. Similar vein, long-term care insurance. You know, what's your view and process towards that? And this is another one, kind of a loaded question. Like, I assume you have to farm it out if and when the time comes where a long-term care policy makes sense for someone. So what's, you know, your firm's approach on long-term care planning and potential usage of insurance?
You know, long-term care is tricky.
It is.
We've seen a lot of changes in it over the last several years. I can remember clearly back in the days at the big firm, GE Financial, before they became Genworth, you know, they were kind of the ones that pioneered long-term care. And they would come in and do their presentations, and, you know, you'd get people to fill out the questionnaires and start going through all of the stuff. And then I think it was John Hancock. There were a few other of the big insurance names that got into the long-term care space. And then somewhere along the way, they figured out, we may have mispriced this, because now our claims are exceeding, you know, premiums received, and there's this imbalance here. So we've got to start going up on these premiums. And it started getting priced to the point where it was no longer really feasible for these people to continue holding on to these policies, or they were having to cut their benefits down to the point where it, you know, it wasn't going to be all that useful. Then we saw life insurance start rolling out, you know, their riders that would pay for long-term care, things like that. So for someone who already has it in place, And it's a good policy. I think it certainly plays a piece, but we always test our retirement plans with, you know, self-funding long-term care. So that's always one of the assumptions that we add in at the end. You know, we have a conversation with them before we build the plan about the length of time they would like to use. And then, you know, what that ultimately does is it, you know, if they die before they need long-term care, they're going to have excess money, you know, money that they could have spent. But instead of buying that long-term care insurance, we're going to take today's average cost of maybe in-home care, inflate that up by a factor, and then show that coming out in their cash flow in the last few years of their retirement.
Okay. Which I think is a good approach. And I agree. This is a really tricky one to have a universal answer to. The costs are just getting so high for existing policies, especially, you know, if they're good, generous policies. People got a tough choice every year, every 2 years, every 3 years, they get a premium increase notice. Like, guess what? Premium's going up 20, 30%, maybe more.
Right.
If you want to keep the same amount of dollar premium, you got to cut your coverage, you know, here or there. So it's like you're diluting what you have. So it's hard. I don't know. I haven't been able to crack that one with a great answer myself. This very specific question, because a few people have asked, what's your deliverable, if anything, around a client's distribution plan in retirement? Meaning, how much money do you take from which account and when? What do you put in front of people, if anything, about that?
So this is an area where I take a departure from a lot of advisors. We have a lot of clients come to us who are engineers or IT people. You know, that worried me at first. Because I thought, wow, have we made this complex? Because we've always kind of tried to approach this with the heart of a teacher. You know, simple is hard. We're gonna break this down and let's make it easy to understand and not get into too much detail here. But let's answer all of those big questions that clients have, like, should I do Roth conversions? How can I avoid paying too much taxes? So on and so forth. And then we started getting, you know, all of these engineers and IT people. And I finally had to ask one of these engineers, I said, look, what is it about our process that's attracting so many engineers? And he told me, he goes, well, no, it's not that you're too complex, Devin. Don't worry about that. It's just that we like to plan, which certainly made me feel better. But, you know, there's kind of two schools of thought in our industry about a plan deliverable. So one is we put all of your stuff in this software and we hit print. And there's this 80-page report that spits out, and we might even bind it for you, right? We might even put that in a binder, and it's going to have your name on the front. And it's going to look pretty. It might have pictures of happy couples walking down the beach and some charts and graphs and things like that. But is it really that useful? No. We've had a lot of those sent to us from people that were trying to hire us because they had no clarity at all, you know? And that's the first step to getting confident in your retirement, is you got to understand it and have that clarity. And then on the very other end of the spectrum are these one-page retirement plans that you see people have. And that's, hey, we've looked at your stuff and here's the 10 bullet points, you're going to be fine. And I don't like either approach. I certainly don't think that the 80-page report with a bunch of fluff in it is necessary, because that's mostly what that is. So what we've done for a deliverable is Excel. And our Excel people are a little disappointed usually when they see that, because they're like, yeah, Excel, now I can play with the numbers. But it's not, we don't do the calculations in Excel. Mm-hmm. We only use Excel for the presentation component of that. So we do use our financial planning software, and in some cases we'll use two different versions to examine a couple of different withdrawal strategies. One of the more traditional withdrawal strategies, or maybe one that's going up to an effective tax rate or averaging their taxes at a certain amount. And from that, then we have a spreadsheet that we've built that we export everything into, where it shows them year by year where their money is coming from, how much they're going to pay in taxes, and what their final balances are. And it's more than three columns, right? I think, yeah, you know, there's 25 to 35 columns, and that's one scenario. But our goal is to make it crystal clear, to get that on one page where they can understand it and be able to see it at a glance. And then we use a program called Loom, which I wish they would have named it something else, because it sounds a lot like Zoom. But Loom is the, it allows you to just do a video record of your screen. It makes it super easy. So whenever we send that plan out, we always accompany that with a video walkthrough of that plan, because there's nothing I hate worse, Andy, than when someone sends me a spreadsheet and I have to figure it out, right? How everything relates to everything else. And it just, it drives me crazy. So in this walkthrough video, we explain how each of the columns relates to the other columns. And once they usually get it on one, then for all of the other scenarios that we've tested, those start to make a lot more sense to them, and they can move through those pretty quickly to see what those results are.
That's nice. That's a really cool approach with sort of the customized. You don't just do the pre-canned output from whatever planning software you use, and you don't just do the super stripped down one-page plan that gives a handful of bullets and says, we're good. You know, it's cool to make your own thing. And the video, really nice touch. I haven't heard of someone doing that, which is, you know, congrats. That's a smooth way to go about it. I'm sure people love it. I'm sure clients love it.
Well, they do. You know, it Andy, if I go to the doctor or if I go to my accountant, it never fails that when I leave, I go, now, what did he say about this? I can't remember. And maybe if my wife was with me, I'll ask her. Man, would have been nice to have that recorded. You know what? Yeah. Now this plan presentation is recorded. They can stop it. They can start it. They can fast forward it if they want to. They can rewind it. They can pause and go drink a beer and then come back to it. They can watch it three or four times. And many of our planning clients will watch it. But there is something about receiving that information in the comfort and thinking space of your own home that does let that soak in a little better. So I would make the contention that having a virtual relationship in some ways because of those sorts of things can almost be better than sitting across the desk. In fact, some of our local clients have now asked us to start sharing our annual updates to the plan through video. And they can, you know, sit at home in their comfortable chair and watch that on their iPad or their laptop. And, you know, they walk away from that with a better understanding than they would have if they were in my office.
And it's on demand and self-paced that they can come back to, like you said. And that's a great idea. You definitely do it different. So, you know, kudos. That's cool. Tax planning. This is always popular. What are some common tax planning opportunities you come across with your clients? We already sort of touched on Roth conversions, but anything else beyond that?
You know, one that you've been on the podcast several times now, and I think two of those we talked about capital gain and loss harvesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it still amazes me, much like it amazes me on fees, how people haven't paid attention to fees. It still amazes me how many people will have a large taxable account and have never paid attention to capital, you know, taking those capital loss harvests. So many of those people still think, well, Devin, I can only take $3,000 a year, and they don't understand how that can accumulate and carry forward. And as a result, you know, they're hurtling towards retirement when they're going to have to start taking distributions from that account, when they could have had a big fat pile of capital losses piled up, you know, let's face it, we had 2020 with COVID. Then we had 2022 where you could have had, you know, more than one cycle of capital loss harvesting. Mm-hmm. And you could have ended up with quite a large amount of capital losses that you were carrying over to offset some of those capital gains, almost effectively turning your taxable account into a version of a tax-free account. And people just miss it all the time. And the other one is the tax gain harvesting that you came on. I think we did an episode specifically on that, being under the capital gains threshold, and they're just bouncing along with these capital gains in there and, you know, not resetting that basis. That's probably the most common thing that I find, period.
Yeah. Agreed. Often overlooked, even at the advisor level, it's sort of some higher level stuff that unless the advisor is truly tax conscious, advisor probably isn't proactively thinking or looking for opportunities like that.
Right. Well, and you know, another one there, and this really relates to the big firms. So a lot of these big firms, and I don't know how they all work, so I'm not going to even act like I do. But I know from talking to clients, and I know from my prior experience at one of the big firms, their advisory program was not managed at the office.
Right.
It was managed, you know, by a group in their home office, or maybe a separate manager out there that you had hired, like a Goldman or whoever, right? And those people are making big batch trades. They're not necessarily looking at an individual portfolio to say, all right, you have a lost harvest opportunity here. You need to take it. So, you know, as a result, you know, it's not always the advisor's fault. It's just that they've got you in this account that's being managed away from that, and it's never being looked at like that.
They're just simply not able to function that way because it's not how they manage. Yeah.
Right.
For the next question, I just realized, for those of you watching the video, I look really washed out right now. So for those who don't know, my office is light gray walls, white furniture. So that's the backdrop. I'm wearing a light gray sweatshirt, and my complexion is pretty pasty at this point in the winter. So it's like just a lot of white gray going on in this video. And anyway, moving on, I saw myself on the screen, like, man, that's a lot of gray and white right there.
Well, I think it looks great, Andy.
Well, thank you. Next question. So how do you balance trying to optimize clients' plans without getting unnecessarily complicated and focusing too much on the minutiae?
So I think there's a balance there.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what was it, Steve Jobs, who simple is harder than complex? You know, I think that to do this job properly, you have to have a deep enough knowledge to make it simple. And you've got to approach it with the heart of a teacher, right? Really, what most of the clients that come to us are looking for are the answers to those big five questions. You know, some of them I've already rattled off. You know, should I do a Roth conversion? When should I file for Social Security? How can I not pay too much in taxes? How can I make sure I'm not going to run out of money? So on and so forth. That's really what they're looking for. And if you start to dive in any deeper, you may lose them. But here's what I will say. You need to be able to dive in deeper.
Right. Dude,
I tell the story quite often. And I hope this guy doesn't listen to any of my podcasts or things, because I tell this story pretty often. So back a few years ago, as I was just starting to grow, I realized that, man, this financial planning stuff takes a lot of time. I need some help. So I reached out to find someone that I could outsource my financial planning to. And I found a guy who had been a CFP for about 10 years, was running his own practice. His practice, I don't think, had been quite as successful as he wanted it to be. So he was looking for some outside work. So I hired him to start doing some plans. And the very first one we did was for a client that lived in either South or North Carolina. And he put this plan together for a Roth conversion. Sent it back to me, you know, with all of the output from the financial planning software. And I started going through it, and I scheduled a call with him to, you know, talk about the results. And I clearly remember asking him, so this doesn't tell me where the taxes come from on the Roth conversion. So where are these taxes coming from? Because I'm seeing the higher tax burden there. And his response was, well, I don't know. The software doesn't tell me that. Mm. And, you know, I realized then how much reliance there is on this software output, which is really kind of sad.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does get some things wrong. And unless you can spot that, you know, it's kind of like the video that I did that time about me having a heart attack. You know, that was horrible. That was a horrible experience. I didn't actually have a heart attack, by the way.
Oh, good.
But,
so I was going to say, I don't know this video, a heart attack story.
No, I didn't. But the EKG said I had a heart attack.
Okay.
And the individual that was reading the results didn't know enough to be able to look at those waves and go, no, this is, you know, a perfect, whatever they call it. You know, my wife can clear me up on that. But it was perfectly normal. But I only found out it was normal after he said, Devin, I think you had a heart attack.
Oh, man. That
has been ingrained. Now, that was 15 years ago. And ever since then, I still hate going to the doctor. In fact, I went for like a 5-year stretch without going to the doctor because of that. And I've mostly gotten over it now, right? I'm convinced that, no, I didn't have a heart attack and everything's fine. But I do think that individuals not understanding the output, not being able to dive deeper than the surface of what that paper says that comes out, can be very damaging to someone's financial future. So, you know, whoever your advisor is, when you're going back over that plan, you need to be able to stop, put your finger on something and say, tell me more about this.
Yeah.
And they need to be able to dive in quickly. But I do think that, you know, answer the big questions. No need to get too deep until the client wants to get deeper. Then you can dive deeper.
I'm fully on board with that. Same thing. Don't bombard them with too much nitty gritty and detail, but you better know it. If they do ask, they want to drill into it. Like, you got to have good, well thought out, justified answers. You can't just say, well, the software says so, right? which full agreement there. How do you determine if clients have quote unquote enough to retire or enough to last them? Lots of different schools of thought on this.
Well, for me, it's pretty simple. You know, I know that a lot of people now were, you know, this is kind of segueing from the last question where we talk about the reliance on the software. You know, most of our modern financial planning software has this probability of success, right? And that, unfortunately, I think has become the meter for if someone has enough, you know, and that's, well, are you above 80%? If you're not, you don't have enough. If you are, you're probably going to be okay. Now let's look at some other scenarios. Oh, wait a minute. This one says you have an 81% probability. This must be better. I just don't think that's a good metric for measuring it. I do think it is very useful for that frontline kind of viability test to make sure that something's not just terribly out of whack that you need to examine. But for me, determining if someone has enough, I think that the cash flow, and that's kind of the way we model out our plans, you know, from left to right, that is what's going to tell the tale. Under using some very conservative assumptions, that's going to tell us, is this going to work? And then, you know, potentially running that through some different stress testing. But, you know, if that doesn't work up front, then I think it's time to go back and start having some other conversations with them about things that maybe they ought to change.
And skip ahead a question. So for clients where that is the scenario where your analysis, your triangulation of processes leads you to believe you may not have enough here, then what do you do? I mean, obvious answer is spend less, right? But like, how do you approach it with folks? Not an easy conversation to have.
It's not, you know, I've always hated that conversation, and it's one that we've had to have, you know, I wouldn't say frequently, but on occasion we do have to go back to people and say, look, your standard of living here is just too high.
Yeah.
So in the vast majority of the cases, by the time someone reaches me, one of the options is already off the table, and that's save more, right? If they're young enough, you can remedy it. Some of that shortfall by just saving more, by getting more disciplined early and putting back more. But by the time they've reached me, there's not enough runway left to really put back enough to make a meaningful difference. So for those people, there's really just a handful of things that they can do. You know, in most cases, they're still working and they're within a year or two of leaving. And that's why they're coming to me to get this plan put together. So they can either work longer, or we can go back and we can readdress that budget. Because what I have found with clients building a retirement budget is you'll have a couple of different types of people. You're going to have the types of people who have been using Quicken or some other tool to track their expenses for the last 5 years, right? And they're saying, I know exactly what my expenses are. And, you know, this is the amount that I need to spend in retirement. And then you have the people that go, not real sure, but I think X. And for those people, when the plan then shows that spending X isn't going to work, it's time to say, let's dive back into this budget and let's figure out, is there some fluff there? And you'll often find that that there is some fluff built into that budget that they maybe hadn't really thought through, you know, or they thought they were going to spend, you know, $40,000 every other year on a car, or maybe $20,000 a year on travel, you know, for the rest of their retirement, you know, and so they're going to be 85 still traveling Europe. And that's when it's time to have those conversations about how retirement spending actually, you know, statistically works for people.
Yeah. And for everyone listening, whether you plan on doing your own planning or working with an advisor, you have to have a good handle on your expenses. it really all starts with that. Now, your expenses will change throughout life, but without at least knowing what you're spending now, honestly, what you're spending now, you really have no basis to determine, am I going to need $5,000 a month, $8,000 a month, $15,000 a month? Whether you plan on needing $8,000 or $15,000 a month in retirement will have dramatically different impacts on right, your plan, whether or not it works. So you have to do it homework, and there's no shortcut. Like that's on you, the consumer, the person. Advisors can help you think of, make sure you cover this, make sure you cover that. Maybe they got some pointers of, people often forget this expense, but you got to go through your records, your Quicken, your credit card statements, your whatever, and tally this up yourself to have a good understanding of it. Similar question, but from the other angle. Now, when someone very clearly has more than enough, arguably too much, yet is reluctant to spend and distribute after a lifetime of saving and building, how do you help them get over the hurdle of not using and enjoying their money?
You know, Andy, I'm sure you've experienced the same thing, but I actually find that is the experience that I have more often than someone not having enough is almost where they, I wouldn't say have too much, although in some cases people do, they have too much and they don't want to start spending it. But where they hit that fear of spending their money, we had a podcast episode not long ago called The Hardest Part of Retirement. And that was what it was all about, because people hit that psychological shift that comes with retirement. And now all of a sudden they're not putting money into that account. They're supposed to take money out. And that's scary. That's scary as heck, because now you're saying, what if, right? All of these different scenarios come into play. You know, what if the markets aren't good? What if inflation goes up? What if I need more health care than I think I'm going to need? You know, all of these things. And so there's the tendency to start getting really hesitant to spend that money. And so I would say that the cure for that is clarity. Right. If you want to get confidence in your plan and in your ability to spend that plan, you need to have a plan that gives you complete clarity, that you understand how it works. And if you don't understand it, you may continue to be scared. And then, for some people, I think this may be a different psychological way that some people are set up. To give you an example, the people who know me know that I love to grill. If there's anything with charcoal or wood and fire, I'll cook it because I love that stuff. And it's what I do on the weekends, and my body shows it, right? So I sold a grill that I had not long ago. This was a Traeger Ironwood 1300 for those that are listening, and I didn't like it. Didn't give any smoke flavor. Tried to use it. Finally sold it. And I think I sold it to this guy for like $1,200. And I took that money and I put it aside, specifically earmarked for me to buy another cooking device, right? Mm-hmm. Much to the enjoyment of my wife, who says I have enough out there. But if I wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't have felt like I had permission to go and spend that money. So I think that's a component of retirement planning that also needs to be added in there. So what we will often do in retirement plans is have a separate line item for specific things. When you hit retirement, that psychological shift happens, and now you're getting a little worried about spending your money. You go, man, I thought we were going to travel, but I don't know if we can afford it. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have a separate line item and you have that money that's effectively already spent, because there it is, it's kind of like it's in a savings account waiting for you, much like that $1,200 is sitting there waiting on me to go out and get that gravity fed charcoal grill, then it kind of relieves you of that pressure of just taking it out of your regular budget and buying that Viking River cruise or whatever it is, because it's here, it's already spent.
Yeah. That's great advice. How do you do with brisket? I love a good chopped brisket sandwich. What's your specialty?
Oh, well, in Texas, it's very simple. It's salt and pepper. That's all you need. Salt and pepper. Yeah. And just low and slow, 225, hour to an hour and a half per pound, and you're going to come out with something succulent.
Do you have a specialty that you're best known for with smoked meats?
The smoked meats are probably part of my weaker thing that I do. With a lot of that, it's hard to mess up, right? So let's take pulled pork. You know, basically you season a pork roast and you put it in there and you keep your temperature level and you cook it for however long, usually that hour and a half per pound. Then you pull it out and it falls to pieces. You know, that's just about anyone can do that. But some of the grilled food that I do is some of my favorites. So I'm a big commando style grill cooker. I love like the green egg or those kind of things. And so I love cooking flank steak. The skirt steak, especially the inside skirt. So any of those things, because again, we're in Texas, right? And so you want to have some spice, you want to have some zing. And so there's lots of tacos, lots of fajitas, things like that. And once you start cooking your own meat and eating it, yeah, you just can't go to the restaurants because they're buying like round steak and sauteing it with some kind of seasoning on it. And it's just not the same.
Next time I'm in your area of Texas, I'm stopping by. We got to
have
some meat. Yeah. All right. Final questions. I might cut one of these out because it's a little weird, but I'll throw it at you anyway. This one I won't cut out, but if you could give one piece of advice or word of wisdom to listeners about retirement planning, what would it be? And note, this is directed towards consumers, not other advisors.
You know, something I say often that I may have heard from someone else years ago, and I just started using it. Now I've forgotten who said it, right? So I'd love to give them credit, but I don't remember who it was, so I apologize. But I do say this quite often, and I have it in some of my written commentary. I'll say it in my YouTube videos, and that is that this is your retirement, and no one's going to feel the pain and mistakes like you will, right? Your financial advisor is not going to feel them. Your brother-in-law, who knows a lot about this stuff, is not going to feel that pain. Your CPA is not going to feel that pain. Only you are going to feel that pain. So you've got to make sure that you get the confidence and clarity you need to go into retirement successfully. And that's kind of my big broad brush to people is don't depend too much on, you know, conventional wisdom, what other people have done, what other people said will work. They're not going to feel that pain if it doesn't work out. You will.
Good advice. And finally, this is a question I'm going to cut, but you might be the last person I ask it to. I don't like to answer this question, but what question do you think I should have asked you but didn't? And what's your answer to that question?
Yeah, you know, man, I feel like it was pretty thorough what you asked me. We went through a lot of this stuff. Man, there's a number of tangents we could have gone down.
Oh, yeah. Right?
There's a number of roads that we could have talked about, but I don't know. Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer. You're just so thorough, Andy. It's hard to find fault in what you
stop. What you I'm blushing. But no, Devin, this was absolutely fantastic. Thank you for joining. For folks who want to find you, whether it's your advisory firm, your various content sources, where can they find you?
Well, we make it pretty easy. You can find me, you know, just about anywhere, but my, you know, YouTube, Devin Carroll, just find me there. BigPictureRetirement.com is our podcast. CarrollAdvisory.com is the website for my financial planning firm. And, you know, there's a few other sources as well, but those are probably the big three right now.
Great. And I'll be sure to link all these in the notes to this episode.
Thank you.
Well, awesome. Devin, thank you very much. Always fun chatting with you. Thanks for coming on, and let's do this again sometime.
Let's do, Andy. Thank you so much. And I look forward to having you back on the Big Picture Retirement Show.
Oh, you know I will. Just name the time and date. I'll be there.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Take care, everyone. Thank you. Well, that's a wrap. Hope you enjoyed my discussion with Devin Carroll from Carroll Advisory Group down in Texas. Great guy. Had a great time talking with him. And hopefully you picked up a lot of good insight from my brother from a Texarkana mother, Devin Carroll. As you said in the show, you can find links to Devin's different spots. You can find Carroll Advisory Group. There'll be a link to that in the show notes. His podcast, Big Picture Retirement. His YouTube channel is there, and also his Facebook group, Social Security Intelligence Members Group. You can find links to all that stuff. And as always, you can find links to retirement planning education stuff as well. The website, Retirement Planning Education. This podcast, obviously, YouTube channel. My company's newsletter, and I feel like I'm missing something. Facebook group. Yes, link to the Facebook group. If you haven't already, it would be greatly appreciated if you would take a moment to leave a review, a thumbs up, a like, a whatever, some sort of positive acknowledgement about this podcast on whatever podcast listening platform you use. If you don't like this podcast, tell a friend, find someone who does, and have them leave a good review. You know what I'm saying? Wink, wink. All right, that's it. Thanks as always for listening. Take care, and I will see you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.